Good afternoon. Do we have audio?
Yes.
Good. We do. So thank you for coming here tonight. We're going to talk about spatial audio, what we can do with it, how we can capture, transmit, and render the spatial audio. Okay. And during this evening, we're going to talk about algorithms and technologies designed in this building in Microsoft Research. You see the names and the pictures on the screen. Hannes Gamper is a researcher in the Audio and Acoustics Research Group. He is not here tonight. David Johnston is right there. Again, this is the person who left Microsoft in 1996 to create Cool Edit 96. And since then, millions of people have used his software. Mark Thomas was part of our Audio and Acoustics Research Group for 4 years. Today, he works in Dolby Laboratories in San Francisco. And Professor Jens Ahrens was also part of Audio and Acoustics Research Group for, I think, 4 years. And then he moved to Sweden, where he is a professor there. So this is kind of the work of this group of people for the last 6 years. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Before all of those algorithms and technologies to become something the final user can use, there is a very large group of people which converted the algorithms into a product. Some of them are here tonight in this build, in this room. Many of them are not, because maybe they are polishing the last bits for the next release of the software in HoloLens. So what is spatial audio? In general, when we say spatial audio, it's also known as a 3D audio. We understand the techniques or technologies or algorithms which can make the listener to perceive the sound coming from any direction we want. This has a lot of applications, even starting with something so trivial like listening to stereo music. When you put your CD in the player, what the sound designer expected is you listen to this on two loudspeakers in front of you, approximately 90 degrees. From the moment you put this on the headphones, what happens is the entire audio scene, which is supposed to be in front of you, goes inside of your head. So if we can give a fake two sound sources and you can make your brain to perceive they're coming from there, suddenly we can drastically improve the experience when you use headphones. Of course, nothing can prevent us to do the same thing more times than we to render through your headphones a 5.1 or 7.1 surround sound and to have and to provide a much better experience when you use headphones. Of course, one of the largest consumers of 3D audio or spatial audio is the gaming industry, which is a very native environment because there are a bunch of objects which are in the gaming space, and we know XYZ of each of the objects. We know their characteristics, which means that if you have a proper audio engine to render this, to make you perceive that the sound is there or there, it natively can improve the experience from the game. And the latest scream is the audio, the augmented and virtual reality devices. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but that was pretty much the talk. Thank you for coming. So tonight, we'll go quickly through the history of the surround and the spatial sound systems and what are advantages, the disadvantages. We'll go to the devices for augmented and virtual reality. What are the typical scenarios? What are the usage and expected usage of those? And then we will discuss the object-based rendering of spatial audio. And this is going to be the first part of the talk. We'll have a break. And during the break, besides the normal socializing we all do and have our water and cookies, there is a demo station there which most of the technologies we are going to discuss tonight are going to be demonstrated, including the latest augmented reality device from Microsoft called HoloLens. In the second part, we will just go briefly through after distributing the door prices. We were going briefly through model-based rendering of spatial audio, something which many of you already will have experienced during the break. And we'll draw some conclusions, question and answers. I'm completely fine if you interrupt me during the talk and ask questions, and I'll be more than happy to answer to provide more details. So let's go to see how this surround and spatial audio evolved during the years. And we start go far back when for the first time we had sound in the movies, which typically is one big loudspeaker in front or behind the screen, and everybody can hear. And what we count on is that the brain subconsciously, when you have a person speaking on the left, kind of places the audio coming from that direction. And when the other person in the right part of the screen responds, we kind of believe that this is the source of the audio. There is no much opportunity to make a spatial audio, except that what we can do is to reduce the level of the audio when the sound source is further away, so we have kind of one degree of freedom, one dimension. The good thing is that once you have this single loudspeaker, the area which it covers is kind of broad and everybody gets relatively decent experience, which was not the case when much later we put a second loudspeaker and then suddenly we have a left and a right channel. And then we can do panning from the left to the right, and then the speaker on the left is rendering more objects which are in the left part of the screen, and even we can do a panning and we can imagine how the sound moves. This was very nice, except that in this particular setup, the listening area where we have a decent stereo experience kind of shrinks. There is a saying that listening to stereo music is for alone people. Years later, the audio community decided, okay, if two speakers are better than one, let's do four. And seemed at the time that the most natural place to put the speakers is on the back of the room, and this is how the whole effort of making Quadro recording started. We had even a Quadro set up for vinyl plates. And this whole story is going quite well to the moment people started to ask, why I have to double the price of my audio equipment? Why I have to have more speakers and more channels? What is the effect? And there was in 60s, a user study done in Philips, which pretty much killed the Quadro. And the reason for this is that it does not bring much on the table. You cannot justify the doubling of the price of your audio equipment. You still have the same small listening area. And maybe there was another marketing mistake. Initially, Philips, which is promoting the technology, was doing some very famous, interesting recordings of sound sources going around. When people sit and actually listen to a nice, good concert recording in Quadro, there was a big disappointment. Anyway, this was scrapped and revived a little bit later as 5.1 setup. So then we have first one more loudspeaker in the center. And the other new thing was that we don't have a good sense of directivity for low frequencies. It is pointless to have them spread around. So we can have one big loudspeaker which can handle the frequencies below 200, 150 hertz and make the other five speakers a little bit smaller. But the key actually was the speaker in the center. Later, if you make experiments and have a Quadro but just with one back speaker and one center and left and right, actually the results are quite nice. You have the larger listening area, and this center loudspeaker as an anchor for the audio scene keeps a good spatial sensation and good impression with relatively large listening area. Of course, later this whole story started to explode. to, you can see 6.1, 7.1, around 9.1, and adding more and more speakers around, presumably improve the spatiality. You get a better spatial sensation. But with all of this, the audio world is still flat. Those speakers, all of them are roughly in one plane around you. So you can do panning, you can show audio sources around you, but not above or behind you, which changes in Dolby Atmos, recently released, which is, can be dubbed as 7.4.1, simply because we have, besides the normal 7.1 setup, a four speakers in the ceiling. So now we have basically spatial audio in one hemisphere. We can literally render sound sources going above us, and this eventually creates a more positive experience. I borrowed this slide from one talk which I gave here in 2007 when we had a special meeting about loudspeaker arrays. Not the ones which are kind of a J-shaped and you put on the stage up in up and left and right to trying to cover the listening hall, but the ones which are just a string of loudspeakers. You can buy them. They are typically installed under your TV. And what we can do is pretty much to form a sound field and to direct the sound, to point it to different directions, and even to send the two sound beams in two different directions. With relatively nice applications like focusing to the listener in home, in museums, you can do multi-beam applications. Let's say when I watch TV, of course, in my picture of picture TV, in the small screen, the latest football game, my wife watches the soap in the large screen, but it would be nice if I can have a beam towards me to listen what actually is going on in the game. So this is relatively easily doable. And here I kept the same slide. It was the best loudspeaker array at the time. This is designed by Yamaha, and you see 42 loudspeakers, and those are the modes. I'll just look at this one so you can form different beams. And yes, you can have the left speaker, you can have the right speaker bouncing from the wall, and you can even bounce it from the wall twice, so you can have the surround speaker. So literally, the idea was to save the wiring and to put the back speakers by bouncing the audio from wall from the two walls and making it to come from behind. And this is kind of nice, which converts this loudspeaker array to nothing else but to a 5.1 audio system. And of course, besides everything else, we can do stereo. We can even point the beam to one of the listeners in the stage. So this is why we are not going to talk anything special, nothing further. What is a common thing between all of the systems we discussed so far? What happens is that the audio designer, which does the design of most of those loudspeaker setup, has so-called channel thinking. This chopper goes on behind, so let's put it a little bit on the rear right speaker and then do a magnitude panning to the rear left speaker, and the users will believe that from the left to the right channel, then the chopper kind of flies behind us. So this is common for movie designers. This is common for game designers. This channel thinking is actually quite seriously and quite traditional, very well understood, very easy. Just you do the panning with the, you're basically with the sliders, and you create a quite decent audio. So the problem here is that you don't know what will be the rendering geometry in your final user. You can create a 5.1 surround sound or 7.1 surround sound for your game or for your movie, which may end up actually on the single loudspeaker of the old TV, which is connected to the game console, or where the users actually look and listen to the movie. And this is one of the issues we will try to address tonight. I have to note here that actually Dolby Atmos in behind already tries to break this channel way of thinking. Practically in Dolby Atmos, we have, at least in the commercial version, for kind of consumer version, we can have up to 32 audio objects. Audio, which are defined as XYZ, and eventually is going to be rendered through those 7.4.1 loudspeaker system. So at the core, at the beginning, already Dolby Atmos tries to overcome this. So what else we can do? How we can make you perceive that audio is coming from any desired from us directions? Okay, we can get 832 speakers, place them everywhere in the listening room, control each one of them separately. Each of the signals is heavily processed by digital signal processor. And in general, this is a practical implementation which is in Technical University of Berlin, which is a good illustration of the Helmholtz equation, which literally says if you have a closed volume and you can reproduce the sound field at the borders, inside it will be the same. So pretty much if you know what is coming from everywhere outside of this room and you can make those loudspeakers to reproduce the sound wave coming from this direction or from that direction, the listeners inside this volume, the conference room, will feel that they are there. That's, yes, of course.
Is the DSP accounting for room reflections and natural modes inside the space?
So in this particular case, looking at the papers from the colleagues, yes, they have taken measures. They measured the impulse response. Plus, again, this is a specialized room. We can do a lot of phone dumping, the reflections and the reverberation in the specialized listening hall. But yes, they do this. And it sounds actually quite well. So what about the headphones? So using two loudspeakers on the ears is nothing new. The first experiment is in 1881, when from several theaters in Paris was organized so-called theatrophone. Means the ability to be there by placing two loudspeakers to your ears. And today we would call this the first stereophonic transmission and basically reproduction using a headphone. Much later, in the 50s, so-called binaural recordings became quite fashionable. Simply put, you do have a mock-up of a human head and you literally place two omni-microphones where the entrances of the ear canal are, and even were specialized microphones for binaural recordings. So what happens? You place this microphone somewhere in the concert hall. You record the two channels. You produce your CD, which carries this sign. Simply put, you are supposed to listen to that CD with headphones. Literally listening what happens here and on the other side. And voila, you're there. It sounds amazing. And when the initial excitement fades, you guys have seen this, you create something new, something exciting, and everybody starts to jump from joy and to like it. And when the time passes, you start to see the defects, and this doesn't work quite well. That's not quite good. So several things happen. First is that the audio scene is fixed. You rotate your head, and you basically rotate the entire concert hall with you. This is bad, and we will discuss this, and I'll tell you why. Second is that if your head size is different than the head size and the geometry of the microphone, you will start to experience some inconvenience. Let me use the analogy of the focus. So the audio picture will be not that focused. It will be smeared. The objects even if you have a single point source object there, you'll hear it like area around, not exactly well-focused audio-wise. And this is because the geometry of your head is not exactly the geometry of the microphone. We'll discuss and we'll decode this abbreviation called head-related transfer functions, but roughly put, your head-related transfer functions are not the same as the head-related transfer functions of the microphone. And there were attempts to address the issue of rotating the head, and you can see something very awkward here, which is pretty much 8 microphones. By some strange reasons, they put pinners there. But presumably, somebody very naively thought that if you can do some panning of the magnitudes, we can create this and to handle the rotation of the head. I will tell you right away, it doesn't work that way. So anyway, this is the binaural reproduction. And in mid-60s, end of 60s, this whole excitement around listening to live concerts or recorded concerts through headphones started to fade, and it is not quite common. So, first, returning back to those head-related transfer functions. So this is our spatial hearing. You will see, I will show you diagrams, but this is a set of filters. Think about audio object source there. It reaches the entrance of the ear canal, and the left and the right, with certain delay, certain attenuation, and certain changes when the sound wave goes around my head. So this is head-related transfer function, this set of filters. If I know your set of filters for all directions around you, I know and I own your spatial hearing. I can make you perceive that the sound comes from there or from there by using the proper pair of filters. So this is a must to be used when we do rendering with headphones, even for stereo recordings. I need just 2 pairs of filters for audio object there and there, and then I listen to stereo music, I close my eyes, and the speakers are in front of me, the audio scene is in front of me, and not inside my head. We are used to that. We know, we put the headphones, the earbuds or the headphones, and audio is inside the head, we kind of expect it. When you hear for the first time a well-rendered audio with the sound sources in front of you, it is not that much of excitement. And once you start to listen to it constantly, returning back to direct feed of your headphones is horrible. You get used to the good thing, to the more realistic thing. Which means that on top of this using of the head-related transfer functions, the next important thing is tracking the head movement. Think about this. We have 2 microphones, and we can localize sounds in direction, elevation, and distance in 3 dimensions. Simply put, we have 2 equations and 3 unknowns. Actually, the equation is 1 because the only thing we can do is to make the difference between 2 signals. This to happen, humans subconsciously sense the first derivative of their head-related transfer functions. We do a couple of degrees movement to disambiguate where exactly the sound source is. If the audio picture moves with our head movement, the brain is confused. So the second important component besides using head-related transfer functions is tracking the movement of the head. This removes the biggest, yes?
On head movement tracking, does it presume that the head is like this and not over to the side, or does that also track?
Head movement tracking is 3 angles, direction, elevation, and rotation.
So they're doing,
yeah. All 3. Adds complexity, adds additional requirements to the hardware, makes it a little bit more computationally expensive, but this is what can increase the realism, the perception of the human to extent I am there. So, let's talk a little bit about this latest screen, devices for augmented and virtual reality. First, let's make a definition. What is augmented? What is virtual reality? So this is those subsets of something bigger, which is called mediated reality. Simply put, in virtual reality, you put something on your ears, something in front of your eyes, something in your ears, if possible, other senses, but in general, all of your senses are simulated by a computer. Gaming is an excellent example of virtual reality. Even when you have just a TV in front of you, you sit on the couch and you play the games, you are not in your room. You are there in that virtual simulated reality. You listen the sounds from there. You see like you are there. Okay, we can boost it a little bit, make it 360 degrees, but this is pretty much what virtual reality is. Augmented reality is when we add objects to the real world. We will see the devices, but technically this means that when I stand in front of this desk, this may not be physically presented here. It can be projected by the computer on top of the actual reality I am in. And we will see pictures about this. But this is pretty much the major difference. I would say that virtual reality is slightly easier problem because we don't have to track the real reality. Augmented reality, we have carefully to track the reality we are in because we have to place an object and with some pixel precision to keep it steady where it is, regardless of the head movements. So, it's also not something new. You see in the right a picture of a virtual reality headset from 1950. And the components since then are pretty much the same. You have to plug in our senses. We don't have much about smell, about tactile, but we do have lots of stuff about vision and hearing, which are pretty much the main senses we have. And what we need somehow to cover the eyes, to do the sensation of our eyes. And that can be a display. Literally, you sit in front of your display. It can be a head-mounted display. Think about helmet with a display like this in front of you. It can be glasses. It can be head-up display, which is also looks like eyeglasses a little bit bigger. It can be even a laser doing a projection directly in our retina. Somehow we have to tease to project into our vision. The sound system, okay, we can have those 7 or 7.4 loudspeakers around us. We can have headphones. Obviously, for augmented reality and for virtual reality, we have to do a head and body position and orientation tracking. And this whole story is expected to be driven by a computer. And when I prepared this slide, I realized that I didn't do anything new. Since 50s, it is the same. This is a copy of one of the slides which Alex Kipman, the visionary behind HoloLens, show it during the presentation of the device in January 2015, and we see pretty much the same components, display, audio, other sensors for keeping the body orientation and position tracking, and of course, a quite powerful computing unit. So, let's see what we do have. It sounds like a science fiction maybe, but this is something which we do have today. I'm not talking about nice and cool and overwhelming demos in the research labs. I'm talking products on the market. And one of the most known products for virtual reality is Oculus Rift. You can see it here. So it's a quite big display. Actually, you put it on your head, it completely covers your eyes, and you can see the two screens inside. You have headphones, and you have a gaming controller, so you can control the game or whatever you are watching through the displays. The device is tethered. It has to be connected to a quite powerful computer with a graphics card which meets certain requirements. But overall, and it's quite expensive, but this is one of the available today devices for virtual reality. For those which want to go a little bit less expensive, this device costs $19.99, and you can put your smartphone in it, and also watch certain 360 degrees movies from YouTube. You can watch them. There is a player. Of course, you'll have to have your own headphones and plug them into the phone. But this is kind of the low end virtual reality device, and also creates kind of quite interesting experience. And since March 2016, this is the picture of Microsoft HoloLens, which is augmented reality device. Simply put, those are displays, but they're transparent, so you can show something on top of the environment. We have headphones. Those are those orange things. Those are two small speakers near your ears. And with this, you can experience, given that given application, you can experience augmented reality. You can place objects on top of whatever you're doing. And let's see some usage scenarios. What we can do with those augmented and virtual reality devices? Of course, gaming is one of them. With virtual reality, gaming is already a virtual reality. But in this particular case, you can see Minecraft played through augmented reality device, HoloLens, literally in your room. You can start and build stuff on top of your coffee table. You can build some stuff on your couch. And the computer will project them into your ears like you're building stuff. Of course. Yes?
HoloLens, are you capable of personalizing the product to, like, the way you hear things, or like your own sight?
Yes.
You
have to do a lot of personalization. It happens seamlessly, but at least you understand that when you have to display, you want to show stereo image, you have to know quite precisely the distance between pupils. Otherwise, you'll screw the image. Same thing for the audio. We're going to talk about this. So this is the entertainment scenario. You see that the person wearing HoloLens, and we have a virtual screen here showing the latest soccer game. Some information here showing the latest the plans, even the traffic from home to work. Lots of productivity. Eventually, maybe not with this generation, but with the next generation device, this may mean the end of the large and cool display on your desktop. You sit in front of the desktop and the computer projects a nice and cool 40 inches display, or if you prefer 55 inches display, so you can watch. You look at the desktop, there is a keyboard projected, and you can start typing if we solve the problem with the tactile feedback. But overall, there is a lot of productivity scenarios. Even today, the device can recognize gestures, so you can do quite interesting stuff. There is a lot of applications of science being there where you cannot be because of air, temperature, gravitation, whatever it is. Even before Microsoft released HoloLens, we already had one flying in the International Space Station. We had the honor actually to tune in to tweak the sound capturing system for the noise in the International Space Station. But overall, all of the applications in the science are countless. In the design and in the art, And that's pretty much the dream of the designer. You do it. You design it into the CAD system. Can you feed the HoloLens device and suddenly whatever you design to pop up on your desktop so you can go and take a look and go around and see how it looks like and have a better understanding of the object you design. In this particular case, we see the person design something for the motorcycle and it is entirely projected on top of the desktop. Also, of course, education. You can show interesting, compelling material right in your house, right on top of your coffee table. You name it. Pretty much all of those augmented and virtual reality devices are enormously rich tool for creating educational content, which is interactive and hopefully will allow our kids to learn faster and better. But let's return back to our turf, to audio. So what we can do, how we can basically make this thing to work for the audio. And I put this slide on purpose to start with something which most probably you know and you experience, but I would like to make a comparison between the vision and the hearing. So let's start with the frequency range. The frequency of the visible light is between 430 to 770 terahertz, 430 being dark red and 770 being the violet, almost invisible, which is in contrast of the audio, which is considered between 20 and 20,000 hertz. What we see here, the vision is less than one octave, less than two times changes in the frequency. It's pretty much almost the same wavelength, almost the same frequency. While in the audio, we have 10 octaves. It's a 2-octave difference between the most bassy sound we can hear and the highest pitch sound. This causes a lot of problems in tracking and propagation of the audio. Converting the frequency into wavelength, the visible light is considered between 700 and 390 nanometers. It's very small, which means light propagates straight. It has a very sharp, nice occlusion, and we have shadows. The audio wavelength is between 17 and 0.017 meters. So roughly, wavelength 17 meters can be between this and that wall. And 0.017 meters is 70 millimeters. This is this big. Technically, this means that for a lot of frequencies, this object will throw a shadow. Let's say high frequencies, they'll go, they will stop, and there will be quite a serious occlusion. While for frequencies which are, let's say, 1,000 hertz, 30 centimeters wavelength, it's non-existent. It just goes around it. And this is inside the audio bar range. You will see a very difficult behavior of the audio compared with the objects we are surrounded. That makes, basically, modeling of the audio wave propagation very difficult. What about the dynamic range? Typically, so it is a little bit exaggerated in both cases. We consider them they are the same. But what we forget is that both human vision and human hearing, they have a very serious automatic gain control, first, and both are processed by substantial amount of neurons between the 2 ears and behind the eyes, around 100 billions of them, which means that there is a lot of additional processing power to squeeze that 140 dB of dynamic range. If you don't do the automatic gain control of the ear, the dynamic range of our hearing is around 40 decibels. This is roughly the dynamic range. A little bit bigger is the dynamic range of the retina itself without basically our iris opening and closing and without the serious chemical processes which change the sensitivity of the retina. The spatial resolution of human hearing is around 1 angular minute. This is, four times the diagonal of a high-definition display, and you basically will be on the border of seeing pixel by pixel. Well, the resolution of human hearing is 5 to 20 degrees. Horizontally, we do better. In front of us, it's around 5 degrees. Vertically, we are kind of worse listeners. We can do 20 degrees roughly. But this is interesting to know because at the end, if you want to trick your senses, we better know how well we can do it. I want to underline here, humans are kind of a 2.5-dimensional creatures. We're used to walk on the plane and don't care much about the elevation. There are species which, especially birds, which actually are 3-dimensional. They fly and they can sense up, down, below. One of the best listeners is basically a barn owl, Tito Alba. And that bird can sense in 3 dimensions a rodent in complete darkness under the snow. So we're not there. I hope I will never have to design a spatial hearing for barn owl. Humans are doing worse. Temporally speaking, vision, however, has a not that good. We are, even this is kind of exaggerated, but let's say 125th of a second. This is why we have movies, because if you show enough fast sequence of images, they see like constant uninterrupted motion. Humans do quite well in listening, however, to sense the difference in arrival of signals, and we're talking microseconds here. Overall, the angle of view, so the numbers here, 130 degrees vertical and 200 degrees horizontal, are when we move our eyes. If you fix the eyes, it's around 90 degrees. This is what we can see. However, hearing, we can see and localize sounds in all 4 pi steradians, everywhere around us. So you see, those are kind of... in one area, vision is better. In other areas, hearing is better. They are complementary senses. And this is the same should be when we design augmented and virtual reality devices. They should complement each other to create a better experience, more realism. Of course, energy-wise, I would say that audio is enormously low-energy phenomenon. At the threshold of pain, those 140 dB, you are basically 20 meters from a space shuttle launch pad. When they launch the space shuttle, it is 10 on minus 5 watts per square meter. While in a broad day, 1 square meter of light is around 1,000 watts. And this is also a good, interesting property of the audio we can utilize in various applications. But overall, human hearing has a very high temporal and low spatial resolution and has unlimited field of view. So, what we can do within this audible frequency and dynamic range, we can deliver audio to one of the ears, preferably for two, but with proper training, humans actually can do spatialization and localization with one ear. There are multiple stories about pilots from World War I and World War II which returned back and piloted planes with loss of one eye. Technically, they cannot do distance estimation, but somehow they learn it. Same thing is valid with the hearing. Yes, we can do localization with one ear if we can have the ability slightly to move our head. And it is possible, but let's assume that for now we deliver audio to both ears. So, what we do have? We have an audio arriving to our ears. What we can do, we can measure the levels. And if the sound source is here, obviously this ear will hear better, so we have a so-called interaural level difference. That's one of the spatial cues. And we can have, basically, interval time difference, because obviously if the sound source is here, it will hit first the left ear, and then it will have to go around the head and to go and to hit the right ear. And on top of that, because of the size of the head, which is right in the middle of the wavelengths, for certain frequencies, it will go straight, let's say for low frequencies, and for certain frequencies, it will have a quite decent shadow. Let's say 10 kilohertz, here we'll have a way lower energy than on the left if the sound source is on the left. So all of those spectral cues, and this is interval time and level differences, are modeled with the head-related transfer functions, which we already discussed. Of course, important role in our spatial perception plays the reverberation and reflections. What I mean, let's return back to the 2.5-dimensional creatures. Human hearing actually really counts on the first reflection from the floor, from the ground. If a sound source is very far away, so I'll have direct path, let's say Marley is asking a question, I will have the direct path and the first reflection from the floor, but the difference in the path will be relatively small. And the brain cannot perceive them as a separate, two separate sounds. From the moment the sound source starts to approach and reaches 2.5-3 meters, I'll have more than a millisecond difference in the paths. And then suddenly our hidden alarm bells in our brain starts to ring. They start to ring because there is a sound source within a 2 jumps distance, which means we may became a dinner. Or maybe this is the dinner. So in all cases, it requires certain attention. Also, there is dynamic and multimodal cues. And a lot of expectation and experience. During some user studies working on the spatial hearing for HoloLens, we did experiments, birds chirping. And we render them down. And we track the motion. And the humans, what they do is instantly looking up. So we are not that good listeners. We have lots of confusion areas. Let's say one of the things we don't do well is exactly that line in front of us. Pretty much at any point of this circle, the frequency spectrum and the energy reaching the ears is the same. You cannot tell where it is vertically. Pay attention when you're talking to somebody. You'll never point the nose to that person, to the sound source you're interested of. You keep the person 10 degrees to 5, 10 degrees left or right. Why? Because you can disambiguate. You can point to that person. If you can localize the sound, your brain can remove the noise around and you can hear better. And we do this subconsciously. So there are a lot of those expectation and experience, and you know how this sound sounds, and if it is muffled or distorted, etc., etc., you can do some distance cues, etc. A lot of things happen actually between our ears. So, roughly put, this is kind of recapitulation. You have a real sound source, it reaches left and the right ear, and we hear it there. If you record and to put into 2 microphones, the sound source suddenly pops up inside our head. However, if you take this mono signal and filter it through the 2 filters or 2 impulse responses and play it through the headphones, suddenly it is externalized, moved out of our heads. What is the problem here? We already mentioned it. This is the fact that we have different heads, different size, different geometry of the penis, different position of the penis, which means that our spatial hearing, our filters, our head-related transfer functions are different, and unfortunately too much different. So obviously, personalization of the head-related transfer functions of our spatial hearing is the key to achieve a good satisfaction of the general audience. And let's see what we can do for them, for the personalization. So typically, given head, and it's, again, It's a pure mechanical process of propagation of the sound. The sound is a mechanical wave. It's a microscopic changes in the pressure. So given the shape of the head, today we can estimate it straightforward by estimating the pressure in every cubic millimeter and how it propagates. And it takes quite a while on a large computing cluster, but it is doable. So if you want to do it faster, what we can do is to say, okay, given this 3D scan, this head, what we can do? So the process of synthesizing the head-rated transfer function is called personalization. Once we do have them, we can do the rendering, and the person perceives the audio spatially. Simply put, from the way you look, we can tell how you hear. Just for the fun, most probably at some point, me and my team will sit and say, by the way, given HRTF, can you restore how you look? But that has no practical application. So, what we can do? We can measure head-related transfer function. That's relatively straightforward. You take the guy or the gal, bolt the head here. There is also basically a safety bell. And we put two small microphones inside the ears at the entrances of the ear canal, and you rotate this 16 speakers rig around the person, stop it every 10 degrees, and do chirp, 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 chirp from the speakers, and you pretty much measure in 512, okay, in our case is 400 because we don't do the lower 90 degrees, but you measure the space, those two filters in 500 directions. Voila, we have your spatial hearing. And then we can do the magic and to trick you out that the sound comes from any desired direction. In general, if you remove the chair, this is a generic tool for measuring the three-dimensional directivity patterns of whatever. Microphones, mostly. Before the chair, this is how we measure the three-dimensional directivity patterns of the microphones in Kinect and how we did the design in a proper way so they can hear and to keep, preserve their directivity patterns. I want to point out to a small detail. You see the speakers here, but there are also microphones. So if you flip the rolls and put a loudspeaker in the center of this rotating set of microphones, then you can make on each position the loudspeaker to play a chirp, and we record at 16 points, you move another 10 degrees, another 10 degrees, and suddenly the same device in the same anechoic chamber can be used for measuring of the radiation patterns. And once we know the radiation pattern, which is function of the frequency, so we know it for each frequency, we can simulate different loudspeakers. Okay, once we do this, we can basically take a look how those head-related transfer functions look like. So it's a function of direction, elevation, and frequency. So four-dimensional graphics we don't have, so this is why let's take a look at some slices of this data. So here we have 62 degrees azimuth. So it's somewhere here, a sound source. And the left ear actually hears quite nicely with some unpleasant dip of 20 dB around 1 kHz. That's the resonance actually of our head. And the phase is, it's kind of pure delay up to 18 kHz. The right ear, however, it doesn't look good. It cannot hear quite well, and it is on minus 20 dB below the magnitude, but hey, the delay is kind of nice and linear. Another way to look at is, okay, this is in horizontal plane. So that's in this plane, you can see that this is the direction, this is the frequency. Okay, roughly at low frequencies, we are equally sensitive because the head is non-existent. Transparent. But once we go higher and upper, we see what at 90 degrees, what kind of loss of sensitivity we have because the head shadows the sounds coming from 90-ish degrees. That's a different look at the head-related transfer functions. Another look is, let's pick one frequency and plot it as a function of the direction and the elevation. And it looks like a cardioid microphone. The ear is right here. We can hear well here in this direction and not that much in the others. And this is the last projection. This is vertically. So this is a vertical movement of a sound source in this direction. And you can see that the left ear hears quite well. Look at the scale. White is plus 15 dB. While the right ear does not perform that great because white is 0 dB, so there is quite a shadowing. And you see those specific features which make our sensitivity for different frequencies quite different. This is what brain uses by slightly movement of the head to sense what is around, neighboring the direction, to pinpoint where the sound source comes from.
So that's just because of the asymmetry of the physiology of the head, right?
So we haven't noticed it a substantial asymmetry in the human heads and in their head-related transfer functions. My guess is that there is. We are not perfectly symmetric, but let me put it in this way. With the precision we work so far, we haven't reached that moment when you will be accounting for the asymmetry. So what we did is we tortured more than 200 people in that chamber, measured their three-dimensional directivity patterns, head-related transfer functions. We did a head scan of those guys with sub-millimeter precision. We did some direct anthropometric measurements, like the distance between the pupils, the head sizes, etc., etc. You see the tools, even with the Teller tape, around 90 anthropometrics. And also we asked them to fill up a questionnaire about the head size, shirt size. Head size is pretty much the circumference of your head. Shirt size is the circumference of your neck. Jean size is basically gives you the circumference of your waist and the length of your leg, etc., etc., including the shoe size. I have to tell in advance, the shoe size does not affect anything above the knees. And this is pretty much a quite large database. On top of that, having the 3D scans allows us to use computer vision and to extract some additional parameters like features of the pinna and some dimensions and orientation, etc., etc., etc. So what we can do? Think about this. We have a person with, we know the anthropometrics, the 92 of them. And then we have a 200 people database. So the question is, can we find people which combine it together to have the same anthropometrics like this guy? But not exactly all of them of our database. Let's say let's do so-called sparse representation. 3, 4, 5-ish, the closest to that person. And if that person anthropometrics are weighted sum of the anthropometrics of those 3 or 5 people, we made a wild guess and say, okay, let's assume that the magnitudes of the HRTFs of those of this person is the same weighted sum as the anthropometrics of the other guys, which is not based on any physical evidence, but this is how it works. And based on this approach and this machine learning thing, we can synthesize the magnitude response of the HRTFs for a known person. And the same thing, what we can do is for the interval or time difference. This is roughly how it looks like in different directions. So we have roughly the shape, and we can estimate this based on the anthropometric features of the person. So using all 92 anthropometric dimensions we have, we can generate a head-related transfer function which even members of my team, which are used to hear those differences, cannot distinguish from measured or very difficult. That's perfect. However, taking 92 anthropometrics from somebody is almost as annoying as sitting for 7 minutes in the anechoic chamber. At least doesn't require specialized equipment. So the question is how low we can go with the parameters while still have a good experience among the general public and make this less annoying. So we can go down to 10-ish parameters, we can go even further down, and in HoloLens, it is transparent. You put the device on, and then you get your specialized head-related transfer function generated for you. And there are several other approaches which we have tried. This is this one, given a 3D dimension, a 3D measured head, literally tries to estimate the parts around the head and to estimate the interaural time difference, and we can do something similar with the magnitudes of the head. We also have tried what if we model the human head as an ellipsoid, so three axes, and then you have your 3D scan and you model your ellipsoid and then try to see who else from the database has similar ellipsoid and then to get a combination of one or two HRTFs. So all of those assume that you have a full 3D scan and you will see how it works on a video which I'm going to show a little bit later. The latest is what we are going to see tonight is pretty much doing just a 2D picture, which is just your face, and then trying to fit this 2D face with some average eigen face and the way you have to press it and to model it to synthesize your head-related transfer functions. That may be not that good, but takes 10 seconds. And this looks like amazing thing, but very researchy. Eigen faces, 3D scans, etc., etc. How close we are? Where we stand on the market? So the headphone you are going to listen to this evening is this one. This is our Microsoft Research development. You see there is a simple board on top of it, which contains a chip which is part of every single smartphone. Means cheap. That's the 3D gyro, 3D accelerometer, and 3D compass. With this, we can track the orientation of your head, and there is a board which is either USB, like this in the one you're going to use, or Bluetooth, so it can go wirelessly. It's a nice research prototype, but there is already a product on the market. It's called Intelligent Headset from Jabra. And the thing, besides everything else, has the same unit in the band on top of your head. It has GPS too, but I don't know what exactly it is for. Even more than that, there is already a product in development which goes and tries to collect funding from Kickstarter, which besides having this IMU, also has a sensors which allow to estimate the distance between the headphones. And this is one of the most important anthropometrics. If I have to choose from those 92 anthropometrics, one, that will be the distance between the entrances of your canal. So this guy, this headphone, you put the headphone on and instantly you know the distance between the ears, which is allows us to do personalization of the head-related transfer functions. The group asked for $100,000. Funding to design the product. In the first 30 days, they got $2.9 million in funding just to scope the interest among the general public. Yes?
These headphones coming out, they're going to be set, so it's only one headphone. Once you've got them aligned, it's just one headphone per person. So if you had a family of four, you'd have to buy four sets, or are they going to have, are they like the Microsoft one you work in, where you can have like different buttons for?
This particular headphone, whoever puts it on, we know the distance, we can instantly synthesize the head-related transfer function. And, of course, if you want to play with this now, but don't want to pay $420 for the Jabra Intelligent Headset, for just $60, you can buy this clip, put it on your any headphone, and your Bluetooth, it's the same thing, the 3D gyro accelerometer, and then you can get it, and so you can start playing with specialized audio. So it is there, it is here, it is among us. It is not something very fancy, something expensive, etc., etc. So once we do have this headphones and ability to create quickly personalized head-related transfer functions, let's see quickly what means to do an object-based spatial audio. So first we do have XYZ of the sound source. It's there. Then what we do have is we should know the XYZ of the listener. And we should know the orientation of the sound source, and we should know the orientation of the listener's head. And then there is a mono sound which has to be convolved with the two HRTFs, and then you can play through the loudspeakers and do this frame by frame by frame by frame, preferably in frequency domain. Voila. So this is roughly the block diagram. You get your 20 milliseconds converted to the frequency domain. Look at the orientation of the object, the orientation of the human head, apply the head-related transfer functions, apply certain reverberation and reflections, and I want to underline here we're talking only the spatial cues. Reflection from the floor, reflection from a nearby surface. I'm not talking about generic reverberation to create the thinking that we're in a church or in a cave. That came later. That's more of the effect which every game designer already has in his or her instrumentarium. We're talking just those cues which allow to create a better spatial perception, and they're relatively short. Okay, this is how it looks. We have an object. This is our lab, actually. It's on this floor. Okay, we have a given object. We've given directivity pattern. We selected this hypercardioid just for fun. And then you place it where the object is. You scale it. You do the orientation. And you place it, because this is presumably the small object, the radio here. Do this for all of the sound sources in the room. And then start to compose the scene from the world coordinate system to the personal coordinate system, which is the head of the listener. This is Hannes Gamper, by the way, the person we don't have here tonight, you know, who also contributed to the spatial audio project. So once you have the point of view of this person, and we know the angle to render each of the objects through their own directivity pattern, then you apply the head-related transfer function of this person, and you generated this for the right ear. We do the same for the left ear. And what happens? So I will show you a video. And it is very difficult to show a video of spatial hearing, okay? But let's try.
And I understand Josephine is standing by with her next demo.
Yes, I'm over in the other corner with Ivan Tashev, and I call him Dr. Audio because he is the go-to guy behind all the cool audio engineering in Xbox and in Kinect. Thank you for bringing all your toys to DemoFest.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You know, when people hear about 3D, they usually think about visual, but you're talking about 3D audio, and that's beyond surround sound, right?
It is beyond, because surround sound is actually flat. We have 7 speakers, but they're in one plane. And the 3D audio means that we can render audio from up, from down, from every single direction.
Wow, so use me as your guinea pig. Let's see how this works, all right?
Okay, let's first play.
I have to sit up here on this chair, because, as I understand it, they have to take a model of my head and my ears. Because why? Is it because my head and my ears actually determines how I hear? I'll give you the mic.
Okay, now what happens is we're going to do a three-dimensional scan of the head and generate the personalized spatial hearing.
Okay.
reach to the back.
I'm not supposed to talk, which is kind of hard. But I was supposed to hold still. And look, they're making like almost a clay model of my head because that is going to affect how I hear. I know, I have no eyes there, but it looks kind of cool. But now, what is this going to allow us to do?
So now what we're trying to do is we try to extract basic features from your head. So the width of your head, the height of your head, the position of your ears, the position of your ear entrances, the width between the ear canals, and we're using all that information to find a subset of measurements that we've taken beforehand that matches your profile so that you have a good experience in the demo.
Okay, and so now I get to put on headphones, right?
Yep. Okay. So we'll put on these headphones, and they're just standard stereo headphones with a little gyroscope basically on top so we know which way your head's pointing.
Hold on, I got to take out my earpiece. There. Okay, so now I'm wearing these headphones. This part is going to be much more exciting for me than for you because I don't think anyone else can hear anything. No. But go ahead.
But what you'll be hearing is sound coming from each of these objects that you see in front of you and in your environment. And you'll think it's coming from there, not from the headphones. You won't hear any sound coming from the phones themselves.
Okay.
Let me start it up for you.
That was David Johnston, also of Microsoft Research, who works with Yvonne. And now, whoa, I'm hearing this guy talking. Do you not hear that? Listen to this. Listen. Oh! Now the radio's playing. Dance party! Oh, you can't hear that, can you? All right. That's amazing. It really does sound like it's coming from that radio. Now the guy's talking again. And what was that? There was like a bird or something. Can you hear that? It's the radio playing. Yeah. That is remarkably. I just heard this. Someone is knocking at the door. It sounds like it. Oh, and now the phone. The phone is ringing. You can't hear, but it sounds like this. That's what it sounds like in my ear right now. And now the marimba is playing. I want to hold the mic up to it, but obviously you're not hearing it. Angry Bird is talking to me. This is remarkable. It really does sound like it. Now everything. This is a virtual concert going on in my head. Oh my God. Okay. Yvonne, I need to talk to you. I'm going to take this off. That is really remarkable. I just want to ask about how this will be used. 3D audio.
So the 3D audio can revolutionize and change even the simple task of listening of stereo music. Because the stereo music is designed to be played by two loudspeakers in front of you. When you put the two channels on the headphones, the audio scene is inside your head. With this technology, we can externalize and play the stereo music with the audio scene in front of you. It is trivial to add surround sound with 5 or 7 loudspeakers, but the big hit is the gaming.
Yes, I can see it with gaming, I can see it with movies. What about people who can't see, people who are blind? I could see how that might be useful.
Yes, we actually are engaged in a project with the biggest charity in the United Kingdom called Guide Dogs. So they are working on a device which is a wearable band across your head with the headphones, and they can help blind people orient and navigate through an environment by playing a virtual sound marker so they can follow the directions and to go from point A to point B.
I know you can't talk about specific products this is going in yet, but I can see a lot of applications. Thank you very much, Yvonne Tashev. And it's also a big hit here at Demo Fest. Chris, you got to try this out.
So with this, we kind of wrapping up the object-based representation in rendering of spatial audio. It is very familiar environment for game designers. They know XYZ of the edge of the objects. They have them into a mono dry sound, and it is straightforward actually to render it. We have all 6 degrees of freedom. We can track XYZ and direction, elevation and rotation of the sound source. And we can do the design which is separated from the rendering. Once you do the spatial audio, then you can think, okay, is this a headphone to apply head-related transfer functions, or this is a 7.1 or 7.4.1 rendering system. Yes?
What is the effect of latency in the whole chain with all this processing that has to happen?
It depends how big latency. So from the moment you move your head to the moment this goes to the computer, it is rendered and returns back to the headphones, if it is below 50 milliseconds, we don't have to do anything. Humans basically perceive it as okay because we don't do very fast movement of the head. We can do certain measures like extrapolation, et cetera, et cetera, but sooner or later, around 150 milliseconds, everything falls apart, and you move your head, and the sound scene does this. Because of the latency, and it sounds horrible. Trust me. So this is the range, yes?
So far, what I've seen is this looks like it's only applicable to over-the-ear headphones, which have proven in the past, and the reason they've gotten away from them over years ago was because of ear fatigue and head fatigue on them. Is this going to be applicable to open-ear headphones? For example, a Sennheiser HD414 or something scenario?
Technically, give a given sound scene and 835 speakers around you, you'll be there. Obviously, when you start to reduce the number of speakers and we're down to 7.1, 5.1, yes, we can do certain step, but that will be barely better than the channel panning, which we already have. Yes, it is possible. Once you do have the scene and you see this in the second part, it is doable, but the more discrete, the fewer number of channels which are in discrete position, the less we can do.
So basically, the better aspect is to have an over-the-ear headphone than an open-ear.
Yes. This is where we can do a real magic. Then this basically starts to underperform. Yes?
How important is the actual scene as far as the number of reflections? Do you just do first order or do like N order reflections to actually get the space?
So
how important is that in the actual...
Again, let's distinguish the reverberation and reflection for just the sake of being in cave or in church or in hallway or in your office, from the reflection and reverberation, which is in addition to adding the spatial cues. It is not that critical, but remember that signal to reverberation ratio is one of the most important distance cues. So the further, literally you may model the reverberation as constant reverberation everywhere in the room, and then the direct path, the further away you go, it is lower level, which means you have a worse signal to reverberation ratio, and then this is how you perceive the distance. If you want to get distance, there should be certain reverberation added to that. It's not that much critical.
Do you actually use HRTFs for the direction reflection as well? You actually apply the HRTFs?
And especially in HoloLens, because the device is expected to place objects in the reality, it tracks pretty much all surfaces around, so generation of authentic reverberation is not a big problem. You have the data. Yes?
Quick question. You mentioned rotation of the sound source. How does that work? I mean, you don't have polarization of sound, right?
So I will give you an example. You have a loudspeaker. Let's say we sneaked in Bill Gates' media room and saw just the number and the model of the loudspeakers there, and we just borrow them for half a day from the store. You bring them into the media, into the chamber, and you measure the directivity patterns of the speakers. And then we return them, but suddenly we have loudspeakers which are, we know, and those sound sources, they can be placed. Obviously, if the loudspeaker points to us, it will be one sound. Once it starts to rotate, it will be a different sound. So pretty much what we can create is the very authentic presence of that particular sound source. If you go just an omni sound source and even today, the game designers know this. Game audio designers know quite well. Omnisource, it does not sound realistic, and they have some very vague models like a cone. So the sound source is sound source like this, and it's zero. So if it rotates, and suddenly you stop to hear it. That's what I'm talking is that we have the capabilities to put the exact sound source with the exact frequency response. You saw the radio, the small radio, which that girl was basically pointing to. That radio was actually measured at them, so it implicitly puts even the frequency response except the non-linearity in the object. because everything we talk here is completely linear processing.
You mentioned reflections, not complicated game programmed reflections, but like a wall or whatnot. So as you're rotating the speaker, are you modeling in a space that's you predefined somehow?
Not
the reflections of that?
So absolutely possible, especially when you wear HoloLens. Absolutely possible. You know all of the planes in that room. You know everything. It is computationally expensive. In the research environment, we can do whatever we want. If necessary, we'll put a 32-core CPU there, and we can do it, and we can amaze you. When the time comes to shipping a real product, then the hands of our colleagues, some of which are here in this room, came to what we can cut from here and from there so we can fit in this particular DSP which sits under the main CPU, etc., 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 etc. So obviously the real product is limited to what is possible.
So have you experimented with that, though? I mean,
yes.
And made some subjective judgments about the quality of the experience and, you know, how much of that do we really need to make it sound real, that kind of stuff?
Not much.
Just a little bit. Okay.
In all cases, for sure, when I'm nearby a large surface like this, and I have a sound source, what I expect is when I approach the surface, I have to hear the combing effect of the interference between the direct path and the reflection. This is a must. Otherwise, this surface is not existent acoustically. There are some things which are important. Some things can be kind of, you can cut corners. Yes.
So if you're switching transfer functions at 50 hertz, did you ever get it as you're rotating, changing transfer functions dramatically at that rate? Was there a modulation? Did you get a 50 hertz buzz ever or nothing perceptible?
Typically 20 milliseconds time frame with... Okay, you don't shift 20 milliseconds, okay? You shift a smaller amount. It is sufficient.
Was that something that you were, like you talked about, like, in order to fit the budget, you have to start losing things, right? You retain the most important, and you use little tricks for the whatever you replace with the trick, right? So following on from that question, about the resolution, about the HRTFs that you captured, and about the interpolation between them,
You were going more and more towards questions which some people in this room are better than me to answer. Those were the guys who actually made the cuts and did the user studies with our assistance, of course. But think about us as a research people which work in an environment where you have unlimited computational power and unlimited memory and enormously fast CPUs. So this is what came out of this, of my team. And then all of the cutting, all of the user studies and scratching of the head with our assistant, of course, assistance, but this was done in our engineering teams. It's a gigantic work of getting nice and cool research project with unlimited CPU power and unlimited memory and converting it into a real product. And we are far from taking any credits for that. This was created by a set of amazing engineers which are basically converted this into a product. Yes, please.
You've talked about the vertical dimension and how it was difficult to get that.
Yes, especially in this plane.
In this plane. Okay. So maybe that's what I'm thinking of in this plane, because what I have understood before is that part of those head-related transfer functions for each individual takes into account the shape of the pinna for each individual, and that the reflections from the pinna have a lot to do at, and their resonant frequencies
yes.
there have a lot to do with that
yes,
vertical
they
dimension
do.
And recreating
they
it.
Do. By the way, did you notice that your nose points here?
Mm.
You keep me 10 degrees off the center,
right.
Subconsciously.
So that angling is going on all the time.
Okay, good. So now, this is the time for break. We have certain demos prepared there. You guys are going to see spatial audio in action. Some of the demos actually are related to what we're going to talk after the break. Typically, we make a 30-minute break, but if we can show you the demos fast enough, from the moment we see that the line there is already short, and we're going to switch to the last part of the talk. It's much shorter than this first one. Okay? Thank you for your attention.